Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dr. Henry J. Krizbylo. He's an associate professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University School of Medicine. And we're talking about his new book, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. Jay, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm happy that you're interested. Thank you for having me.
What pushed you over the edge to write this?
Oh, boy, that's kind of a long story, and it's convoluted in a way that you wouldn't expect.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you're right. It had to do with my wife, and she suffered a brain aneurysm, a ruptured aneurysm.
Wow.
And she was never quite the same afterwards. And I was looking for something that I could do while spending time with her. She wasn't physically impaired, but she did have some impairment psychologically and mentally as a result of it. And so there were things that she couldn't do anymore. And it was good for me to come up with something that I could spend time with her and still feel being productive. So that was the initial salvo.
This is a very personal book. Not only is it a great book to introduce people about what anesthesiologists do and how they operate in the history of anesthesia, but it's also a lot of your personal cases, many of which are really fascinating. You're a pediatric anesthesiologist, and that presents real challenges that are different from being an adult anesthesiologist. Talk about that.
It does present challenges, but once you get used to it, you understand the issues. And so instead of having to flip back and forth and say, okay, I need to be aware of this. Okay, now I'm an adult, I have to be aware of that. You get used to it, but it is different. It's not just a matter of size. It's a way that the child uses oxygen, energy. It's the way they breathe. It's the way their hearts react. So there's a lot of different things associated with a child as compared to an adult. One of the slides that I had picked up on during giving presentations was a slide of a baby sitting in a full-size bed. And the caption is, babies are not small adults. Adults are just big babies, and that pretty much sizes it up.
But there's even challenges for instance, just prepping the person for anesthesia. You know, sometimes you give a shot. Children are really afraid of shots. They're afraid of the mask.
You have to be much more personable with the child because they aren't going to allow you to give them a shot. I mean, it's the one thing that they're going to always remember. He gave me a shot. So you don't want to do something that's going to be too injurious to the patient, and yet you have to be safe. Most of the kids go to sleep by breathing through the mask, and now you can give a pre-medication before, but the pre-medication, it turns out that a good solid talking or iPad is just as effective as giving an injection or a medication, and you don't have the after effects of the medication. So it's either have a good mouth, an iPad, or get ready to have them cry a bit with an injection.
Getting just generally about anesthesia, you write about anesthesia that even modern science can't explain. That actually struck me by surprise. I thought we would have it all figured out and knew what exactly was going on.
And we're not even close to it yet. We just know that the drug works. It works very effectively. But exactly how it works is anybody's guess. It's interesting. You think that just when you're getting used to figuring out a way and a reason, something stops you from it. There appears to be something in the cell wall of the brain that the medications work on, but it doesn't work on other areas of the body, which is very conflicting, very confusing.
You describe this as the most frequently performed medical procedure that entails risk to the patient. About 40 million people a year go under anesthesia.
Correct.
And for you, the ideal thing is to have a totally boring event, correct?
That would be the that would be a nirvana for me. to a point, I guess. You know, you probably get too bored, and then you probably do something silly. That's what you're searching for is a couple minutes on the front and the end of deep intervention and excitement, both you and the patient, as they're going under and as they're emerging, and then everything in between. You just want to be unmemorable for everybody.
Talk to me about the image of railroad tracks.
The railroad tracks means that we make a chart as we're going along the time-wise. So it starts from the time that induction, or time zero, if you want to call it that, and you move along with time. Every 5 minutes, we're charting a record of vital signs of every imaginable means, and oxygen saturation, and then the percentage of anesthetic gas you're giving, and all these. And what you'd love is railroad tracks are nice and parallel. They go from left to right on the screen, and if it's flat, it's flat. It's absolutely beautiful. Your patient isn't changing vital signs. They aren't getting excited. They aren't getting too depressed. They aren't having blood pressure spike and then drop down. So you'd like them to just be like a railroad track going right across a plane, absolutely flat, level, no change.
Describe your command center. You're there at the head of the procedure table. What's it like for people who've never seen it before?
Yeah, it's I refer to it as my anesthesia nest, because that's where I spent most of my waking hours for the last 25, 30 years, over 30 years, but we won't go there. So you have the patient in front of you, and if that's the 12 o'clock position, so the patient is immediately in front of you, and to your right, a couple of hoses come into play, and those are the hoses carrying the gas to and from the patient through the mask that's going to the patient. And then you start getting onto the anesthesia machine, which has all the gases on about a waist-high level, and with a table there with all your other medications that you'll need, both for the case itself, and then your emergency medications. And then you move up, and you have a couple of different monitors. And the monitors are first for the machine, so they're the gases that the patient's receiving and breathing out. And then above that is a shelf that has another monitor on it, and that gives you all your vital signs. So you can, with a quick swipe, see all the vital signs and the gases and everything that the patient's breathing. You continue to go back a little bit. Now you're pretty much behind the patient, behind me, 180 degrees, and that's the anesthesia cart, which has all the equipment that you might need. You hopefully won't be going to it much. Hopefully everything you need is on that anesthesia machine. But all the extras, everything else you could possibly need, medications, monitors that you might not routinely use, bags of saline for IV and this and that. You come around a little bit further, and now you have your it would be about three-quarters of the way through the circle. So around 270 degrees or so, there's going to be an IV pole. It's going to have the IVs running to the patient and the medications that you're going to be giving IV. And then you come back around, and now you've got the patient again. So and that arc is about 6 feet across, and that's the majority of the time I spend my life is in that arc.
What's the oh shit shelf?
You're one of the rare that's actually gotten to talk about that. The couple people have mentioned it, but in passing. The oh shit shelf is right by the monitors of the patient, not the machine. So you have the machine, then above that is a shelf that has the monitors on it. That's also the oh shit shelf. And that has the big drug of all at this particular time, which is epinephrine. So when the blood pressure is going wrong, when the heart rate's going wrong, that's the first medication you're going to reach for. And basically, why is the oh shit shelf? If anybody says, oh shit, my hand's going right to that shelf until proven otherwise. So you try, you're always watching the patient, making sure everything's fine, but you hear that and the right hand automatically is grabbing for that epinephrine syringe on the oh shit shelf.
Now, is there a standard layout? I mean, is this the same from hospital to hospital, from anesthesiologist to anesthesiologist, or do you customize it over the years as you've learned to learned where everything is and what your particular needs are?
It's basically a standard layout where most places will be in that area. Some of them have the monitor for the patient's vital signs a little bit differently. either between the patient and the machine, or on the machine, or a little bit behind the machine. So the monitor screen changes a little bit. I prefer it as forward as possible, so I don't have to take my eyes off the patient. But sometimes they move back a little bit. Outside of that, things are changed in terms of size for pediatrics to adults. But it's basically the same setup. So it's just different sizes and different sizes of syringes that you need based on the patient's weight. But they're frequently the same.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Henry J. Prisbylo. He's an associate professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University School of Medicine. We're talking about his new book. It is a really both fascinating and interesting and entertaining sort of memoir and history, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. You describe what you do generally as I erase consciousness. I love the fact that you use that phrase. You put people in a coma. As a person who's gone through full body anesthesia, it's amazing. It's not like being asleep.
It's a very different state. First of all, let me thank you for praising me. That's very, very kind of you, and I do appreciate it. But anesthesia is a very different state, and it's tending to coma. So it's a chemical coma as compared to, well, the others are chemical, but man-made, you know, head injuries, whatever, patients that are in comas for that lack of sugar, whatnot. It's that same pretty much state in coma. So there's no breathe and no dreaming. There isn't.
And even when I'm asleep through night, there's some kind of sense that time has passed. I may have the amount of time wrong, but when I came out of anesthesia, it was like nothing. I was missing a chunk of time.
Absolutely, you are. I'm not watching you.
Yeah.
So I remember the whole thing, but the patient, it is definitely lost time. And that's absolutely fascinating that it prevents the storage of memories, but it doesn't erase the memories that you've had.
That's right.
And so it's utterly fascinating from that standpoint, and that's one of the things that's so intriguing about it, is trying to figure out how it's doing that. But it does it.
One of the things I love about your book is you also have a history of anesthesia in the book. The first use of inhaled ether to enable a safe, painless surgery occurred March 30th, 1842. What were the circumstances?
That was a patient that was down in Georgia, and Crawford Long was the physician at that time, and he had a patient who had some lumps on the neck, had one of them taken out without the anesthesia, and was paranoid about it. And Crawford Long comes along and says, you know, I've got this technique here that might help you out and might eliminate that fear and might eliminate the memory so you won't feel anything, be pain-free. And so administered anesthesia and did the surgery himself, and did not document it very well. The only document that we had that ensures that this patient had an anesthetic was the fact that he billed for it. He billed for the ether.
Was that the first bill for anesthesia?
That's the first bill for anesthesia. I think it was 25 cents, as I remember.
Oh, whoa.
So he billed for it. And then the guys up north, Morton, came along a few years later, made a big production of it, and had the ether dome in Boston.
Right at Mass General Hospital, right here in
Mass General Hospital. Still going strong. But they were intelligent enough, or he was intelligent enough, to make sure that he had coverage for it. So the surgeons were on board, and he had press ready, and so it was a big deal that he did it that way. And God, you know, touche to him, he did it the right way.
Wow.
Where Crawford Long was just a little backroads guy and didn't want to get into much.
Now, you list 5 A's, and I want to take each of these in turn.
Sure.
Okay, because each one is an interesting discussion in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the things that you're concerned with as an anesthesiologist. Number one is anxiolysis.
Anxiolysis, anxiety relief. That means, you know, people get all worked up beforehand.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an attempt to try and bring them down onto a steady basis so they don't feel as upset. You know, when you get upset, first of all, it's just a feeling that you have that you don't like, and I don't want my patients to have to experience that. But beyond that, there's also that causes issues with blood pressure and heart rate and everything. So you want it to be nice and smooth. So anxiolysis is the first one. And in the children, it's just lots of talk, or it might be an iPad. In the adults, it might be some medication through an IV that started, because they will accept the IV without a lot of pain and discomfort and running away, getting further in your view as you're trying to talk to them. So the adults can get some benzodiazepines, midazolam, Versed, something like that.
Number two is amnesia. And right. I love the way you describe this. Easy to achieve, easy to screw up.
Yes, it is. Amnesia is also given by higher doses of the benzodiazepines. Is also given by the anesthetic gas itself. So there's several different ways that you can attain amnesia. And one of the things that tends to happen is you forget about it. So if you have a gas on board, you're going to have amnesia. But if you're not doing it with gas, if you're doing it with something else for other reasons, you're giving it by IVs, you might not be constantly remembering it, and your patient may not be able to move. Which we'll get into a little bit. So right. That's what I mean. It's easy to attain, but easy to screw up, because you got to continue it throughout the case, so that they're comfortable. So that's what that's about.
Number three is interesting, because this became a major analgesia became a mm-hmm. major concern of yours later on in your career due to an event in China. And let's talk about analgesia as relieving pain.
Right.
But now, something happened to you in China that really sort of brought it to the forefront of your concerns.
And it brought it to the forefront not necessarily because of the case itself, you know, performing the anesthesia for the case itself, but remembering that the patient has to wake up. And when they're waking up, you want them to be as comfortable as possible. And so analgesia is a necessity during the case, but you're doing that with gas anesthetic, and that's gives you tremendous analgesia relief, pain relief. But the gas has to be turned off. And now you have this painful condition you didn't go to sleep with, or possibly you did if you were injured beforehand, but you wake up with it and it's, oh my God, this hurts. This is terrible. And so now how do you take care of this? And that's where we get into the narcotics are our big stay, and narcotics are causing all kinds of issues
today. Oh, yeah.
People are becoming increasingly fearful of using them, but they're still the best. And then you have other things like one of the weaker ones is Tylenol. You're given something, but you're not given a lot. Personally, when I have a headache, you know, I don't grab for the Tylenol. I grab for something stronger. So you have other medications that you can use, Toradol and ibuprofen. Toradol is an IV, intravenous form of the ibuprofen, Motrin. You can take over the counter as medicines. That gives you nice pain relief, but it doesn't give you stunning pain relief. So narcotics are still the big ones in this regard.
You also became very concerned with patients who are not able to communicate their pain well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and over the years, many of them, so many of them. First of all, the ones that are too young to speak, but the ones that have some sort of brain injury on them. Cerebral palsy is giant in my practice, but you also have other brain injuries. And then you have people who might have a breathing problem and have a tube in their mouth, a tracheostomy, a tube through their neck, and they're not able to adequately converse what's going on. So that's a big issue, is trying to take care of these. And the ones that really opened my eyes were the cerebral palsy kids who just couldn't tell you anything. And you think you're doing okay, and even the parents are saying, you're doing okay. And I'm not sure if the parents misunderstood or if they were afraid of the medications that I was giving was too strong and might hurt their child.
Right.
But it was pretty impressive when I realized that I was under-treating these kids. And it initiated through a couple events, one of them being in China, one of them being at home watching a show in insomnia. Wake up in the middle of the night and there's nothing on TV, and you turn it on, and oh my God, here's a show about pain relief in these patients, and a patient with cerebral palsy who grew to adulthood and was able to describe through a speaking computer and what it's like. So yeah, those things came very close in time, and they were very, very altering to my career, hopefully in a positive way.
Yeah.
So analgesia is, you know, the gases work well. So when the gas turns off, you still have to have pain relief. And then the other mechanisms of pain relief are the regional blocks that you can
right.
use also.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, number four, akinesia.
Akinesia means not moving. Now, if you give a deep enough anesthetic, The patient is going to be so deeply anesthetized that they aren't going to move. But you have points during the case where you may not be aware of it. There's differences in the intensity of the case going on from the surgical standpoint. So let's say we're doing an orthopedic case, and you might be doing something on a hip up by the waist, and the surgeon's cutting, the surgeon's doing something on the bone, tremendous pain relief necessary. You've got your anesthetic up, and now it's time off for a break because we got to get an X-ray and we got to make sure that the cut is accurate or the screw is put in place or the plates are appropriately placed. And so then you have this downtime. So now you can understand where you're having this decreasing anesthetic needs. And if you can give a drug which is going to literally paralyze the patient, you can somehow smoothen off that anesthetic a little bit, that the patient won't move regardless if there's a little bit of a stimulus, and there might be a momentary bump in blood pressure. You adjust it quickly, and it comes down. So instead of the surgeon always saying, he's moving, no, they're not moving, and now you're trying to make sure that their anesthesia is stable. This is where you get into the recall, going back to the amnesia, that if the anesthetic isn't deep enough, there can be recall through this, and you can't, the patient can't respond. So this is a dangerous period. This is a period where you really have to watch, but akinesia really smooths out the surgical procedure for them.
And finally, areflexia?
Areflexia. That's the big one. That's lassoing the clouds in the sky because it's a concept that you want the patient to be stable all the time. You want their heart rate to be stable, their blood pressure to be stable, their breathing normal, they're nice and pink, nothing's changing. And so it's attempting to make sure that you're staying at that level. And as I said, the surgeon makes a cut in the bone, and now it's time to get an X-ray, and the blood pressure might fall, and now it's a way to get that blood pressure back to normal, so through medications that aren't necessarily anesthesia, that can be for kicking the heart or in terms of heart rate or in terms of the amount that it's pushing out with each beat. But akinesia is kind of the arts side of anesthesia, making sure that those vital signs are nice and stable, railroad tracks across the page, regardless where they're at in the procedure.
One of the things that people always wonder about is, why can't I eat before surgery?
Now we get back to the four-year-old with the Captain Crunch.
Oh, my God. That story in this book is the four-year-old, you're about to wheel him into surgery, and he just goes to, I've had a bowl of Captain Crunch.
Yep.
And he's 4 years old. And
4 years old.
It's not like you're talking to an adult, and then he won't explain how he did.
He just shuts up. And what do you mean, yeah, Captain Crunch?
Oh, my God. Reading that story, I freaked out for you.
It was interesting.
So what do you do in a case like that? Okay, the kid says...
On that particular, the first thing is that you want to make sure there's nothing in the stomach.
Right.
If you have something in the stomach, you have acid production, because acid is what's used to break down the food or whatever's in the stomach. So you have this acid. When you have anesthesia on board, you don't have the ability to cough, and you also have low muscle tone. So one of the things that happens is when you have heartburn, when you've had something that's a little bit too much, and it just you burp a bit, and the next thing you know, you got that burning feeling in your chest,
right.
And that's heartburn. That's the acid coming up from the stomach. Well, under anesthesia, you have that burp, but you don't have the ability to say, something's wrong and that it's hurting. And furthermore, if it comes up high enough into the mouth, now your vocal cords don't close as they always do when you're awake, because they're anesthetized also. So you have the potential for this acid coming up from the stomach into the esophagus up to the mouth, and then the potential for it going down as the patient takes a breath. And that causes an aspiration pneumonia, and that's a really nasty, potentially fatal thing.
So you had this young patient, who tells you, I've had Captain Crunch, and that's all. So what's your first move? Who do you check with?
Well, the first thing I did was first of all, he was all left alone, which was pretty surprising to me. Everybody had just disappeared, so no parents, and he's alone. And so I call the floor, and I'm talking to the nurse, and the nurse is being very polite. Doctor, he can assure you he did not have any Captain Crunch. He's been NPO, nil per os by mouth, and I've made sure of that, and this and that. And then go back to him, and I say, you didn't have it. And the words come out again. I had Captain Crunch. And so go back to the nurse, and the nurse is not quite as polite this time. He did not have Captain Crunch. And so go back to him and say, you know, no, I didn't have it. And then he says, I had Captain Crunch, and, you know, my mom gave it to me. And so call up again. Now the nurse is getting very upset, and she's ticked off at me. And no, the mother hasn't been here, so he didn't have it. So go back, and after several volleys of this, with the nurse getting more and more upset, you know, I say, okay, I'll believe him. He didn't have Captain Crunch. It wasn't there. And take him back to the operating room and induce anesthesia. And there was one tiniest belch. It wasn't much. Most people didn't see it, but boy, so I sure did. And sure enough, his mouth was full of Captain Crunch. There, but for the grace of God, go I. It was amazingly lucky that it didn't go down his throat. Was able to turn him and suction it out and get it out before it went down anything bad. Found out he snuck a box off the his roommate's bed.
Oh my and, God!
Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! So it was very true. And I wanted to go up and say something to that nurse, but you know, I thought, better leave well enough alone. You know, we got lucky here. He didn't aspirate, but he sure could have.
There's so many great cases in here that are, first of all, they just really reflect your own humanity in dealing with your patients here.
I thank you for that.
But you deal with a gorilla. And we're not going to have time to tell the whole story, but you actually get to anesthetize a gorilla. That must have been amazing.
It was absolutely stunning. The gorilla had a partner of mine, Andy Roth, had anesthetized the gorilla a couple days earlier for a bowel perforation. And the vet at the time said, this is a wild animal. The animal's got to go back. And my partner's saying, you know, what am I supposed to do? And sent the animal back to the zoo. And now it's 3 days later, and the animal's in critical condition because he hasn't been eating. And is dehydrated, weak, and approaching death.
We're going to have to end it there. People are going to have to buy the book.
Hey, buy the book, absolutely.
find the thrilling end of that story, because it's a really interesting story. There are many fascinating stories in this. My guest tonight is Dr. Henry J. Prisbylo. He's an associate professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University School of Medicine. And we're talking about his new book. It's great. It's history. It's a personal memoir. And it'll really tell you about what's going on in anesthesia when you go in for surgery. And I think that's wonderful. Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. Jay, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was very kind of you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.